Hello, fellow Egypts. Welcome to Taranoia with me, Tara Flynn, one of the biggest Egypts around, really. But we're all Egypts, aren't we? If we're honest with ourselves, we're all Egypts, but we're all doing our best now. As usual, when I have a guest, it is a non-Egypt. And I am fangirling like crazy over here because one of my favourite podcasts is the Irish History Podcast. And I have in the actual studio, actually in real, actual life, it's Finn Dwyer. Yay, Finn, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much for having me on.
It's, you're real. I always sort of picture you in a past, just like in a Norman castle or something, coming down the hills with the Gaelic lords. But you're here and you're in modern day clothes and everything. So, Finn, we were talking about it just before we came on air, and I spoke about this a bit with Mary McAuliffe when she was on. Is history, well, I'm obsessed with history at the moment, partly because I don't want to listen to present day news. Is it escapism or can we learn something? Do you think I'm running away or do you think I'm running towards the future with knowledge of history?
I think there's definitely an attraction in the past when we, in given the world we live in at the moment. Like, there are very serious problems about in the short term, and probably then in the long term we face a crisis that maybe arguably no other generation of humanity was aware they faced anyway in terms of climate change. So there is an attraction then in looking back into the past where
it's a different time. They didn't know they were doomed.
And the problems they faced, we all know that they overcame them because we're here, so they survived. And that said, there are things I think we can learn from that moving forward. There's so much in the past. Generally speaking, there have been huge gains made, for example, in the short term and in the long term. Humans have achieved great things. And I think we can look at that.
You're going to make me cry now. Getting very emotional.
But there is things that we can look at, particularly in the last 150 years, in terms of women's rights, in terms of workers' rights, in terms of the way we understand what human life is worth, like that people have a worth, an individual person has a worth. That has been transformed in the last 150 years. So yeah, I think there is things we can learn. At the moment, I'm in a pessimistic view of the future.
Stop it. Get out. You're not allowed. No.
So what we can learn.
Bring the hope from your Norman castle.
There is, I guess the big question is in the long term is, can we look into the past and find societies that were able to completely orientate themselves in a long-term way? And
Yes, your face is saying, yes, there are loads. No, yeah, no,
you struggle to find them. You struggle to find them. Like the change, the Roman world didn't collapse. It changed into something very, very different, though. They were aware of some of the problems they faced, but for one reason or another, weren't able to keep the old structures together. Now, there's parts of today's world that we don't necessarily want to keep, we want to change, but that's the one thing that maybe there are things in the past that people have overcome in a long term, looking to change long term things, but humans are really good at, like I did it yesterday, look, there's a story about, there's a huge problem in Antarctica about a huge ice shelf that's going to fall into the sea. And it's talking about flooding. This is going to flood lots of cities if this falls off because there's so much water in it.
Yeah, I've got some waders at home. I'm planning ahead.
I scrolled through the story and I literally said, I saw 50, 70 years and I was like, oh, grand. I was afraid this was going to happen in like 5 or 10 years. So when I saw 50, 70 years, I was like, I might not even be alive for that. But like, I think that's the problem is that like deep inside me, I do care about these things, but deep inside me, there was a... Going,
there isn't that thing, and you mentioned it a tiny bit at the top, but they weren't aware, so things might have been bad, but they weren't really aware of things outside of their own local community. And this thing that we have this global awareness now, constant, that we can sit there and catastrophize all the time, and we're not built for it. We're built for these small communities, I think we're wired for them, and suddenly we're part of this giant community and this doom that we're sort of aware of. And even though we might not be here for it, you know, we do care, but we can cut off because we have to. Sometimes we have to cut off.
Oh, for sure. Like, there's only so much. There's no point in being burnt out and just like constantly worrying about a problem. Like, the point is to change it. So I think that's whether changing it means you think about the past and see how people have succeeded then, or as some people can do, constantly talk about the present and change it. The worst thing, I guess, you can do, though, is to constantly talk about the present and do nothing about it because there's no purpose to that. It just makes you depressed and probably makes other people around you.
So my top tip for that is listen to history podcasts and buy waders.
By waiters, we're all going to need them.
So listen, you're here as a huge favourite to me, and I can't thank you enough, because I love all your podcasts and I'm learning loads about the famine and all of that and our mental health during the famine, things like that. You have really, if you're not listening to Finn's podcast, please do. It's so entertaining. Even if you think you don't like history, it's presented in a brilliant way. If you love history, you'll absolutely devour it. I love all your podcasts. I have some favourites, which you're aware of. It's the witch ones. You have some witch podcasts, and I'm interested in how witch history influences maybe the way people exhibit misogyny today. Do you think there's any correlation?
I certainly think that they come from a similar place, they reflect similar tendencies maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's worth saying, actually, in terms of this stuff didn't go on forever. We always have this tendency to think that problems today are almost built into humanity. I'm not saying like misogyny is very old. You can find it way back in deep history.
Women for ages.
But in terms of witchcraft and that type of victimization, I think you can trace it back. Like certainly, it only, for example, witch trials, one of the first was held actually in Kilkenny in 1324. One of the first in Europe, first in the world, of what we understand it.
This was before the big European kind of witch craze, which is 1400s.
Even later, like the really big, I guess the big ones are, there's big ones in Germany in the 16th century, in Scotland in the late 16th century. Then I guess the most famous of them all is the Salem witch trials, which are kind of at the end of it in the 1690s.
When it went to the New World, they took it with them.
They took it with them. And interestingly enough, they're taking the ideas that came up in Kilkenny. Like you can see similar ideas, and in terms of, there's interesting aspects of these. Like, for example, there's a sexualization of the woman being accused, and there's a sexual component to it where often she'll be accused of having sex with the devil or an incubus, which is a representation of a demon, and that can be in the shape of a cat or a dog, or in some cases a black man. It'll vary from story to story.
But I have all three of those in my house. I'm married to an African American. I have a cat and a dog. So I would have been burnt at the stake, basically.
Yeah, I think
for
I guess,
all kinds of reasons, which we might go into later.
I think they're probably maybe getting back to the original, or going to maybe where the original question was. It is that it's like, what though unifies this over? We're talking about a huge sweep of history, and this stuff went
and geography,
in,
yeah,
yeah, across like societies in Europe that are very different. And then into the more recent past, where you have in the 19th century in Ireland, Bridget Cleary is burned in the 1890s. Now, the reasons or the logic behind that trial is actually very, very different from things like Salem. The rationale or irrationality of it is totally different, and it comes from really old pre-Christian traditions in Ireland and the warping of those.
And pishogues and superstitions.
But at the same time, you can see these similarities, and you have to ask, why are these things similar? So Bridget Cleary is a woman. The majority, not all, but the majority of people executed in witchcraft trials are women. There's definitely a gendered nature to the violence of them, to the logic behind them. There's a sexualized component to them. And you have to ask, why is this? And there's lots of theories that people have come up with over the last 100 years, or the people have been studying this. And you see there's a common time where these come up. Bridget Cleary is a bit of an outlier because it's very unusual. So maybe we just park that for a second. We can come back to it.
It's worth a bit of attention on its own, I think. Yeah.
But the others tend to happen in times of high anxiety in society, where there's a fear of the future. People are fearful, so they lash out. Sometimes people...
It's someone to blame, isn't it?
It is. And then it can be quite specific. So the victims in these, the people who are called witches, tend to be women at the periphery of society. So in those societies, they tend to be maybe older women who are single, who are widows, whose maybe place in the world is a little uncertain. And that is a big thing. You know, they're not, in a really brutal way of looking at it, they don't maybe make as much for the community anymore. They don't work as hard. maybe they look after kids, but maybe those kids now can look after themselves and they're out working. So their status in the community. So people have pointed to this, that in this moment of crisis, maybe where there's also less resources available, that it's a way of attacking the weakest in society. Also, though, at the same time, you can look as well at women who might be in quote unquote uppity.
And inconvenient. Yeah.
And maybe so, for example, in that first one that I talked about in Kilkenny in the 1320s, in 1324, a woman in Kilkenny called Alice Kittler is accused of being a witch. Now, the problem actually around a lot of this stuff is, and it's, I think some of the reasons we like it, is these things tend to be embroiled in mythology. And like, but like when you actually strip back and go, what do we know about this? Alice Kittler wasn't, she's always portrayed as this like beautiful young woman. Alice Kittler wasn't that. She was a woman in her 50s by the time she was accused. So she wasn't this young, kind of hyper-sexualized person that you'd often see in books.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like the younger ones, the younger inconvenient ones were sexualized and the older ones were hagified, that hag trope.
But what it's really interesting about her is she was one of the most successful people in Kilkenny in the 1320s.
And nobody likes that.
And she is really, we know there was serious resentment against this. It's also kind of feeding into some of the other ones, a time of serious anxiety in society about a fear of the future. And then you can see how these come together then as this resentment of this person who's a bit getting a bit above their station. Now, you obviously have a series of really crazy ideas that are brought to Kilkenny by a bishop in 1317. But I think we could wonder, would she have been victimized in some other way? The way it has to, the way it happens is that she's attacked through these ideas in the that they come from the papal court in Avignon and Rome.
So there's a religious persecution element.
There is, but I suspect in that community at the time, they were going to lash out at someone because they were in a very, very serious problem. 10 to 20% of the population had died in between 1315 and 1318. They were under serious pressure from the Gaelic Irish community who'd been under attack for hundreds of years and now were starting to attack back. And you've got a Norman society that's really starting to wonder about its future. They don't know, their internal cohesion is breaking down. And we can see it time and again. One of the great ways to build cohesion, and I'm not saying this is the reason they're doing it, but it can be subconscious. A great way to build cohesion is to attack someone and create like you can't defeat the big enemy, so you create someone in the community that you can attack.
And people were desperate. Like there was real poverty, there was real uncertainty. So the stakes, if you'll pardon the expression, but the stakes are high. And so people needed someone to lash out at. And of course, just to make the distinction, we're not talking about practicing Wiccans. We're talking about people persecuted as witches. Hello, Wiccans. You're very welcome. Welcome, Wiccans. I always wanted to say that. We're talking about people who were persecuted as witches, with no connection to witchcraft at all, except that it was something they were accused of. Although some were healers, I guess.
Some would have been, herbalists, I think. Like, and they can incur the wrath of the church because they believe in a series of ideas that hark back to older traditions. And the church actually, in the early medieval period, didn't really have a big problem with this. But in and around this time, we're talking about the year 1300, maybe a church that we might recognize a little bit more today, one that is adamant, there is like, you're with us or you're against us.
Okay.
Starts to come into being. Why that happens is a totally or another debate.
Check out Finn's podcast.
But the church that we might recognize are some of the foundations maybe of those attitudes. We're talking about 600 years ago, so it's a long, long, long time ago. Maybe starts this idea of one way, our way, and if you step outside of that, we will hound you. Now, in the Middle Ages, being hounded for stepping outside the norm puts you in an extremely dangerous position. Mm-hmm. For example, in relation to other things, they came up with the term outlaw. You're outside the law. You're not protected by the law anymore, so anyone can kill you. Obviously,
that literally means?
Yeah, you're an outlaw outside the law.
So you're dehumanized completely by being outside the law.
Anyone can kill you. You're not protected by the law. Obviously, today we don't do things like that. But I do think you can fight. No, but you could, what I'm saying is, I think we do attack people in the same way, and society does it. But we have different ways. It is not as acceptable.
Yeah, I think depending on the part of the world.
I should say I'm referring to Ireland
yes,
today.
Yeah, that's a good distinction to make, I think, because we're seeing it in a lot of places. But I agree, yeah, this dehumanisation, allowing people to disconnect morally and believe that someone is... The stoning still exists. That was something that was used as a punishment for witches. And that still happens today around the world.
Yeah, and I would say... things can change very quickly in a country.
We
can think that we have like a highly cultured society and where we can, history doesn't always move forward. And that's a mistake that we always tend to think. If you look at Ireland in this country, if you're a woman in 1913, you looked into the future with hope that things were going to change. And in 1918, things were changing. Ireland elected the first woman to the British House of Commons, which is not an insignificant thing to do. Mm-hmm. Within 6 years, women had participated in the War of Independence and participated in the Civil War, but within that time, their actual position had started to go backwards again, even though they had. And so I guess what I'm using that as an example is that we have this tendency to think, oh, everything we have now, well, we'll just build on that and move forward.
That progress is linear, that rights are permanent.
Yeah. And like, that's not to say that, you know, and I don't think history is a one thing moving, you know, you can have aspects moving forward and aspects moving back. Like, I don't think... like, obviously, I think Ireland's independence was a positive step. But when you dig down into it, there are seriously negative steps to that. Like, what happens in the 1920s in this country is really bleak for an awful lot of people, particularly women, where there's a very conscious intent on the part of the government to drive women out of public sphere. And they're very open about this.
For ages.
Yeah. But what they want to do is they really want to roll back into, like, they're abhorred by people who have been advocating for the vote, for women organising in trade unions. This is not the vision of Ireland they want. And that's, it's not, it's a very different type of marginalisation. But you can see similar processes at work through different times of history. Now, I'm not in any way, just to be clear, I'm not in any way paralleling witch trials in the 1300s or in the 1600s with that, but what I'm saying is you see these processes at work of like of driving people to the margins of society, and then those people tending to be people who don't fit in. And obviously what fits in changes from decade to decade, from century to century. What fits in today may not fit in tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Dara Cushay.
I'm Ala Majekadumi.
And I'm Patrick Kovanek.
And we are part of the Motherfucklore team. Motherfuckers podcast are words, Irish, Irish words, and words from Ireland.
It comes every Friday on the Headstuff Podcast Network.
So join us for an irreverent and sometimes insightful but always exciting look at the Irish language, Hiberno-English, and all sorts of word games at play.
Biggie out.
The common link I draw, I mean, because they're not parallel at all, of course, like there was a Holocaust in terms of witch trials in Europe. That was a very, very serious loss of life. So we're not drawing those parallels. I do see a direct line, though, in terms of shaming and, as you say, marginalising people. The shame aspect, shame was used as a tool for silencing in this country for a very long time. And I see a similar little tendency of use of it as a tool online. And I think that's really interesting. So in the olden days, you know, your times, Norman Lord, Gaelic Lord Norman Castle, sorry, that's what I said at the beginning. It was the stocks, it was the village square, it was putting a scold's bridle on someone. And if someone doesn't know what a scold's bridle, do you want to describe it or? Okay, so a scold's bridle was like a kind of a helmet, almost like a knight's helmet. It could be kind of a mask, an iron mask, with a fitting, a little bit like a horse's bit that would go into the mouth of the person. Usually women, for gossiping or speaking out of turn or suspicion of being a witch, to literally silence them and discommode them and keep them from stepping out of line again. And sometimes I think shame is used as a sort of a non-iron scold's bridle, like, shh, shut up now or you'll get it.
Shame actually was a really important part of witch trials, actually. So,
and humiliation,
One of the things that was really important was the person would be... tortured in some occasions or searched. But for what they were always looking was what was called the devil's teeth. Just it would maybe be a birthmark where they said that the devil actually connected with the woman. This was carried out by the town hangman or the executioner. Now, executioners at the time were considered to be, I suppose, dirty is the word, or like you would not want, a woman would not want to be touched by the hangman or the executioner, because she would then be almost seen as a fallen person.
Would she have to be touched by the hangman for that, though? Would she not already be considered fallen?
No, well, a lot of women, we know that a lot of women, to avoid it, would admit it. So they avoid. So what I'm saying is there's a shame being built into this, that to avoid this utter humiliation. And but there's a whole, I think there's interesting parallels you can make to that about what goes on online and like people avoiding things because of fear of, and what other people think. I think, like, again, these are like, we're looking at like very different.
We're making a silly kind of comparison with something very, very serious. But the line, I think the through line is that, interesting.
That there is that level of shame and avoidance. And you can see it in like these things. I think what is interesting is things repeat themselves. Society changes and societal norms and what's accepted. In Ireland in 2019, the majority of people wouldn't accept that type of behaviour. They accept lots of other things, but that type of behaviour is no longer acceptable. Other things are. And you can, like, some of the ideas and general attitudes behind them can persist. Like, that said, these are very different worlds, and the way people understand women and gender relationships are entirely different in the early modern period than today. But then there is also, you can't get away from it, a relationship between men and women that...
And I think something that falls right in the middle of that is, so we've talked about early modern, so sort of Middle Ages, and then we've talked about the present a little bit just in terms of online. But in the middle of all that, sort of the bridge between that is the Bridget Cleary case, which is outside of both and yet connected.
Yeah, like the Bridget Cleary case, on one level it's extremely unusual what happens there, because there's no point in making generalizations about late 19th century life in Ireland.
Your episode on that is so brilliant, by the way. I knew the story, but the detail in your episode on it, the emotion that it generates, I was out for a walk when I was listening to it and I burst into tears. It's a beautiful episode and I really think everyone should listen to it. It's recent history and
it is,
these like things can happen.
It's very recent in that we're talking about, like, my grandfather was alive when this happened.
Wow.
So I think what we probably, maybe in terms of some of this is to, like, what happens to her is horrific. Like, if people don't know, she's actually burned alive by her husband in her house because he thinks she's a changeling and she's been essentially taken away by the fairies. That is unusual for 19th century Ireland. That doesn't happen at all. Like, that's what makes this case. But when you go, then you start asking, well, why does it happen to her? And what is motivating it? It's kind of these, like, what is going on in society? And then there are other things that happen around this where he really badly beats her in the run-up to this when she's sick, and he thinks, and she won't take this concoction that's created by a fairy doctor, and she doesn't want to take it. And she's basically getting sick and tired of something that probably tastes awful, is not going to help her. She knows it's not going to help her. And he really badly beats her in her house. And there's about 9 people, I think, in the house at the time, and none of them at that point intervene and go, what are you doing? And I think that is maybe more instructive of, you can see that level of why this happened, because there's an intolerance of, now maybe at the time he takes it a step further than most people at the time would have went, because you can see it at the time, there is... people are shocked and appalled by this. So I think it is important to look at things.
Contextualize that. Yeah,
and look at things. They are changing. Like, you don't move from extreme violence to like lower levels overnight. There is a change and you can see it happening. But there is an extreme level of violence in that story before it moves to this, to the burning of Bridget Cleary. That is instructive again of like, where is this coming from? Interestingly, the ideas around that are totally they're rooted in really old Irish traditions, not the actual burning. That seems to be driven in the story by another man, Jack Dunn, who emerges like, as a really sinister individual. He's like driving the
Iago to the Othello in this story. He seems to be in Cleary's ear, just going, "Yeah, she's a witch. Your one is a witch."
It really does. Now, Cleary himself, he doesn't create Michael Cleary, but he definitely, you see him through that series of events. He drives it forward, and his backstory would be interesting. But again, I think a lot of these things, I think it's useful to remove it away from individuals.
Because,
you know, otherwise then it's just Michael Cleary is about, like, and we see this today. If it's just an issue of one bad person.
Even with cancel culture. If you just go, that person tripped up, oh, they're cancelled. It's like, why is what they said useful to learn from? Or why are you cancelling them and not just, you know, do they deserve cancelling? Or is this a pattern? Or is this a one-off? I think it is interesting because the individual isn't the interesting part, really.
Yeah, it's a society that some of his actions seem to reflect. And then what I'm saying is, so like the burning her to death in the house doesn't reflect Irish society at the time, because we know it just doesn't happen.
And it was shocking, shocking.
And it is important to say, like, people are, like, if you read newspaper headlines, in a way they can give you an insight into how people, because if it's normal, they don't, you know, if you read about a murder or a death during the famine, say, for example, by the later stage of the famine, they just don't really report them because it's not.
Oh, wow.
They certainly stop reporting because you've reported this story time and again, and the people who read the story in 1847 are dead themselves. You know, it's becoming so natural in sight. But my point is that newspapers tend to report on things that are, you can see if things are abnormal, and they definitely acknowledge what happens to Bridget Cleary as unusual and abnormal at the time. But again, we're coming back to some of the other stuff that happens around it. The fact that he beats her and her actually members of her own family are in the house when that happens. And no one, they do ask him to stop, but like the level of what's going on, it's like there's bigger questions there. And then I think that's where you go, okay, so we have those ideas rooted in old traditions and all the rest of it, and the fairy doctor and belief that she's a changeling. But then you go, okay, it's kind of what I mentioned about Alice Kittler earlier on, is like, these are ideas, but you have to look at, is there other things beneath them? Yeah. And I'm not saying these ideas aren't important. They are important because people do believe them. But there has to be other things as well adding into this mix.
And I think animosity that grows, or a jealousy, or like a fear.
Bridget Cleary fits into a similar pattern, in that Bridget Cleary was a unusual woman. So first of all, her and her husband didn't have children, which at the time would have been seen as unusual. I think they'd been married 8 years when this happened.
You still get the dirty looks if you're the woman without the children, and it's, especially if it's by choice. But I mean, there are so many reasons why people don't. Yeah. But in those days, it must have been very difficult for them.
And she had her own business. There was rumours that he was having affairs, that she was having affairs. They were basically an unorthodox couple. This may explain this sinister individual we talk about, Jack Dunn, who's the whisperer in the ear. And does he see? So this is a time of great change as well in Ireland. Not necessarily people aren't afraid of the future, but maybe there's a little bit of optimism in some sections of society in Ireland. Like, let's be honest, the 19th century wasn't great in Ireland.
Well, there wasn't a high point.
The idea of leaving it behind, there was few who were. But there is actually a sense of change in Ireland in the late 19th century. The land war was starting to deliver major changes in terms of land rights and things like that. But there's also a technological change. Like, railways have covered the country in the later 19th century. Bridget Cleary has a sewing machine, and you do have this.
So all this was happening when all that technology was here.
But I think there may be a relationship that an older generation, to an extent, which we have seen ourselves recently, see the world slipping away from them to one degree, represented in some ways by a woman like Bridget Cleary, by her sewing machine, by the fact that she doesn't have, maybe as they see it, that she doesn't have children. She's like maybe independent. That this older generation, to an extent, see. Now, this is, I will say, hypothesis. Like, I'm not the first by any means to say this either. Like, but it is, we don't know these things. But you do, like any historical event, you have to contextualise it.
The pattern you see.
Yeah, but you contextualise it in this, that you have this time of change. That said, the Bridget Cleary story compared to, say, Salem or other big witch trials in Germany in the 1520s or 30s, and Scotland in the 1590s, are very different, and they're much more common. Whereas Bridge of Cleary is an outlier, a real outlier, and it makes news all over the world.
Oh, like, did it?
Yeah, like all over the world. Like Ireland, it shocked people like it did in Ireland. It shocked people across the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Australia, America. It was, you can imagine it. Like it was a story that people could not really believe.
I think another common theme is damned if you do and damned if you don't. All the witch trials, all those things we know, like even from the Monty Python films, you know, if it sinks, if you sink and drown, you're innocent. And if you don't, you're a witch, so you'll be burned or hanged or stoned. And that still exists, I think, in many ways in terms of it's very hard to do or say anything about, say, reproductive rights without being, you're too much, you should be quiet. You will even get called a witch. Yeah. And there were some practicing witches who were pro reproductive rights. And in fact, in every village, there would have been the woman with the herbs. So before there was the technology of availability of abortion, let's say, there would be the woman in the village who could sort you out with herbs.
There's a very, very interesting, in the life of St. Bridget.
I love Bridget.
So she doesn't, it's worth saying actually, St. Bridget never existed. She's kind of a hodgepodge
That's not true, Finn.
But
Finn, that's not true. She was a goddess and she's real and she's with us today. Go on with your science. Continue. Okay.
Well, what's interesting though, at one point is she prays over a pregnant woman and then the woman is no longer pregnant. And I think that's instructive, just that ideas change.
Mm-hmm.
And our attitude towards the whole discussion and debate around choice, while the anti-choice side tend to frame it as this age-old, that somehow the pro-choice side are somehow totally transforming the way it's not the case at all. Now, people in the past thought about these ideas in very different ways to the way we do today, but it's not by any means a new idea. It certainly has changed, and like the 19th century was a time of, in many ways, huge social conservatism, where there's a push back, not a push forward, it's a push back in some aspects, that changes attitudes to this. And understanding, a lot of the knowledge is lost. So understanding how this worked in medieval societies, we don't know. But there is evidence that it obviously does happen. And as you say, like, people needed these services. People needed them then, they need them now. How they happened in the past, I'm sure it was very hit and miss, like all medicine was. All medicine in the Middle Ages is an extremely precarious thing.
A lot of people died of poisoning because the dosages, they would take poisonous herbs that were meant to stimulate a miscarriage, basically. And the dosage was impossible to get right. But then there's another link with witchery, because whether it was a male or a female, but mostly if it was a woman doing the administration of these herbs or these potions, if the pregnant person died, they were then, of course, accused of doing it on purpose, or there were all kinds of suspicions were there. The suspicion of having medical power anyway, that was always a kind of seen as an almost supernatural thing. I think that's why the church didn't like them too. It was like, God heals, you can't.
I think there is, and I think as well, like these figures, if you have for want of another term, but what most of us would understand as a herbalist, maybe in a community, often maybe an older woman who might be the midwife of the community, very important figure.
Yeah.
Through the rise, when you get the rise of the church, these people become, there's a rival. So like in the later 19th century, or the particularly after the famine, Irish society is ripped apart. Really, like, it's very difficult to appreciate how on its knees Irish society would have found itself in the 1850s. A million people had died, a million people had emigrated, and emigration was going through the roof. Evictions were happening. Like the physical landscape that you looked at was actually changing really rapidly as well. And the Catholic Church move in very, very quickly. There's often kind of a conspiracy theory drawn up around this. There's nothing conspiratorial about it at all. There's Catholic Church has been growing in power in the decades of the early 19th century. And by the middle of the 19th century, a series of events happens. An archbishop comes back from Rome. the church is reorganized, but it is there and it is able to take advantage of the famine. And it starts to, priests become more and more powerful in communities. They become kind of political leaders by the later 19th century. They're a spiritual leader and like a community leader. And these figures then that might have an old knowledge that rely on things that the church don't really have a knowledge of, they're hostile to them. And I think those, I think the church is very hostile. Now, there's other reasons that you can look deeper, I think, into like church teaching on women and things like that, that would make them very dubious about these characters in general and a misogyny. But I think on a very fundamental level, in terms of raw power, these people are a threat. And like which are fairy doctors who can be men as well. You know, it's
like the Bridget Cleary case.
Bridget Cleary, the Dennis Ganny, who's the fairy doctor in that case. And it's hard to know what his role, like he's kind of somewhat removed from that in that case. Like he gives the actual concoction to make her better. But like what his actual involvement is not. But these figures anyway, people like Dennis Ganny. It's actually quite interesting. If you look up the 1901 census or the 1911 census, one person entered their profession as a fairy doctor on that. Sorry, that's a total
They're
list.
Cool. I want to find out about them. Yeah.
Now you can find out probably what was the last recognised fairy doctor if you look up the census. It's
I can't
online.
Wait. I can't wait for that podcast all about the last fairy doctor and then podcast, the Hollywood movie starring Finn Dwyer. Finn, where can people find you?
IrishHistoryPodcast.ie or the Irish History Podcast, wherever you find podcasts.
Yay, I just love it. We're going to leave you at the very end. I did a show called Not a Funny Word where I talked about my own story of travelling to find a fairy doctor. So basically, no, it was my own story of travelling to have an abortion, but it's a very simple story. But it's also about the telling of the story and the people who would have ended up calling me something like a witch. So I wanted to look at, so in song form, I sum up that little journey. So it's called Burn Her, She's a Witch, and that'll be played out at the end. But before that, I just want to ask you, Finn Dwyer, thank you for being here, but what makes you paranoid?
Actually, following on from this conversation, social media, I think.
Oh, that makes you paranoid. You're great on social media, though. Is it something you...
No, I left Facebook, actually.
Oh, you did?
I just find, it's very hard to explain, actually, but definitely that would make me paranoid.
Does it make you... So do you find it makes you second-guess yourself, or... we were talking about earlier, do you stop yourself saying certain things?
Yeah, definitely sometimes.
Okay.
You know, because it's kind of the thing, you're throwing something into a void and like nothing might come back, or like something that could come back.
The hounds of hell themselves.
Literally, you could bite your hand off and come back. It's like, so I think I don't know, it's a very, very, very strange way to engage with the world, I think. And it can be really good. And I think if you engage in like, podcasts and all like that, it's probably important. So I go back and forth on that, whether it is actually important. Like, but anyway, I'd like to think with it. I explain away the time I spend on social media by saying I do it for work. but it is good. It has great ways. It connects people who wouldn't previously be.
It's a
connected.
Brilliant connector. That's for sure.
But it can be. I don't need to tell you, but like.
I know, but you know, I do miss. I miss certain aspects, and I do miss, for instance, helping to spread the word of the podcast. So everything sort of happens on the podcast for me now. Podcast and Instagram. I do miss it in certain ways, but in other ways, I find like. The contract is with the world is strange, but it's also changed from when, like 2009, when I first started using social media in a really daily way. It's changed since then.
Yeah.
I used to use the analogy of you'd open the door and, you know, when you open the door, a breath of fresh air comes in and you can see all the flowers in the sky and a few slugs might make their way in, but that's the trade-off for opening the door.
Yeah.
Now you open the door and it's like slug city.
Yeah, I know it is. Like there's a...
It's changed.
There's a really horrible word. Like actually I see people, there's a couple of people I really like to follow
on Twitter.
The garden's
still there underneath.
It is, but like I've noticed in the last couple of months, like, people describe, because Twitter is the only social media platform that I use, and a couple of people that I follow and I really enjoy their commentary on Twitter, but like how they refer to it as hell, and like they're actually there's three different people who do it, who I've seen doing it, and actually are women. But
what a shocker!
But it's but it seems to be quite, just judging on it, it can be quite isolating or something, because even though you're surrounded and these people connect and engage with lots of other people, and they are seeing the reality of themselves, obviously, because loads of people follow these people, they're really engaging, put up great content, but they seem to find this really sad. Like, it's not, and I think there is a thing, it's not good for us. Like, social media can't, it taps into something inside. Like, we all, like, admit it, like to admit it or not, when you put up something on Twitter, you do acknowledge how many likes it gets, and you do.
You want engagement. If you're putting it out there, that's why you're out there. And I think
that can be, I think that taps into something very dangerous, not dangerous, but very deep to the core of us in terms of our like personalities and self-confidence. And that is you want to be really careful. Like, it was like Blind Boy said it about your confidence and happiness needs to come from within you.
Absolutely.
And, you know, maybe you can say, like, you could extend that maybe a bit to people around you. You know, there's no, like, if you're a good friend, there's no harm in deriving. But if you're getting, if you're dependent on someone you don't know who follows you for some unknown reason, giving you happiness, that's like really dangerous. Yeah.
It is. And the thing is, then there's the conversely, if you're swarmed, if people are coming at you.
Yeah.
To get you for a certain reason.
I should say I've never actually had anything like that.
No, not everyone does. And that is, when that happened to me, I couldn't leave the house. So, you know, people say, is online as bad as offline? Online is offline. You're offline. So when people are, it's not that you're sitting there going, oh my God, they don't like me. Because I've been a comedian for years and years and years. I've, you know, been out in the public eye. I've had bad reviews. I'm able to take criticism. When somebody comes at you when there's all that energy projected at you from a mass amount of people, there is something very scary about that. And you do feel very alone. And then the solution for me was, what a revelation. I don't have to be here. I'm here by choice. And so when I was no longer allowed to be myself, I was made into this kind of weird avatar, someone to throw rotten fruit at. I was in the stocks in the village square.
Definitely.
And I went, I don't have to, I can unlock these stocks and I can pop off and just put up cat pictures on Instagram.
Yeah.
And it's been much healthier for me.
Yeah. I can only imagine. It's because I think it does tap into some strange part of our brain as well, like where all that information is going. Just it is. Before, can I just make, I want to make an announcement about another podcast. There's a podcast series that's in the making at the moment, and it's called How the Yes Was Won. And it's going to be interviews with people involved in the yes side of the referendum. It's going to look at basically the history of the Eighth Amendment. And there's a group of people who are involved in campaigning in Dublin Central who are making this.
Oh, brilliant. That'd be great.
That will be out, don't know when, but it's into the future, but it will be coming. But if people want to find us, it's on social media. It's How the Yes Was Won.
Isn't it something that is amazing? That's something that was so immediate for all of us. Definitely very immediate for me. It's now history and being recorded.
Yeah.
And with that, Finn Dwyer, thank you so, so much for coming in. I cannot tell you. I'm fangirling like mad here. Thank you so much. I can't wait to hear.
Thanks very much for having me on.
In the future. Here's Burner, She's a Witch. Thanks for listening, fellow Egypts. Woman, know your place. Be beguiling without a hitch. Your nagging turns the milk sour. Burn her. She's a witch. Don't talk back now, girl, be nice. Don't get wrinkles, stay young. Or you're a witch, girl, you're a scold. Put a spike through her tongue. Cross your legs now, be demure. Be the perfect virgin bride. If you aren't chaste and pure, you'll be banished, flayed alive. not enriched. If you're poor and you're alone, burn her. She's a witch. We love them both. Don't want you to regret. Unnatural acts could lead you to your death. We love them both. We know what's best for you. Just need you to make our lies true. Woman made my cow sick, burn her. There's hail in June, burn her. She's almost 39, burn her. She reads too many books, burn her. I heard she doesn't wax, burn her. She was crying in the pub, burn her. I've lost the remote, burn that witch. My Wi-Fi's slow, burn her to the ground. Close your legs, slut, you asked for it. Baby killer, stupid bitch. Man-hating monster, childless demon. Burn her. She's a witch. She's a stupid, gormless, immature, evil, callous, ruthless witch. She's a vicious, heartless, frigid, horny, doesn't know her own mind, bitch. Love them both.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.